Men are the fruit of grace. They answer different questions. Is Paul's emphasis on grace correct? That's what we're dealing with in the first few chapters. How are the Old and New Covenants related? How is the Old Testament related to the New Testament? Does grace discourage disciplined living? Logical question that comes from understanding what Paul's saying in chapters 3 and 5. The answer is in chapters 5 and 6. And we're going to be looking at the first 10 verses of chapter 2 tonight. And again, the theme is authenticating Paul's message. One of the things that we're going to see as we look at verses 1 and 2 is that Paul subjects himself to spiritual leaders. And it's important to us to note here that the leaders weren't asking Paul to come on the carpet to be corrected. Paul initiates contact with leaders. That's the point he's making here. Beginning at verse 1 of Galatians chapter 2. Then after an interval of 14 years, this is after his conversion, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along also. And Titus was a Greek person, not Jewish. And it was because of a revelation, that is, God had spoken directly to him about this in some way, that I went up. In other words, he was not called up there, but God told him to go up there. And I submitted to them the gospel which I preached among the Gentiles. But I did so in private to those who were of reputation, for fear that I might be running or had run in vain. Now, there are a number of observations we can make here. First, Paul initiates contact with the apostolic officials in Jerusalem, and he seeks their endorsement. Secondly, he was completely open about his ministry. He lays before them what he'd been preaching. He'd been doing this now for several years, but he lays it out before them. He wasn't basically coming as though they should listen to him. He was coming with an ear open to their approval. After 13 years of ministry, he was still willing to submit his message for their approval. And the point he's making to the Galatians, who were questioning Paul's authority, was this. He's saying, basically, I've taken the initiative, after 13 years of doing this, to submit myself to their authority. And as he's going to say, they approved of what I was doing. Now, we don't know exactly what the objection to Paul was, Paul's message, but we can suspect that it would be the same kind of objection that many people today have to a certain emphasis in Paul's teaching. Paul talked about radical grace. And there are a lot of people today, as there were no doubt then, who felt as though Paul had watered down the will of God. The notion that somehow Christ died for our sins and we no longer have to be obedient to be justified, that is, be obedient in terms of the law, was something that was seen as basically taking an end run away from responsibility. And there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, Paul just wanted to be popular with people. He wanted a message that everyone was going to buy. Here's Joel Osteen in the flesh, you know, in the first century. Just preach the American dream and people will come. And Paul, if you remember last week, said, I didn't rob from this. Matter of fact, what he says in Philippians, and he will say a letter later in this letter, he suffered greatly because of what he was preaching. And even now, he's suffering as a result of that. So Paul makes the point, and we don't know what the question was, we look at the answer. Paul makes the point that this did not profit me. I'm not doing this because I'm a man-pleaser. I'm doing this because God spoke to me. He goes on. We can tell a lot about whether we're going the right direction by looking at who resists us and who endorses us. Verse 3, Galatians 2. But not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. But it was because of the false brethren who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. We did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour, so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. Now, the people who were objecting to Paul were, by and large, Gentile converts to Judaism and Jews who have been converted to Christianity, or at least they were believers, they were followers of Christ as Messiah. They were basically pressuring other converts to go back to not Judaism, but to being law, to respect the law of Moses. And the idea was this: Messiah Jesus came as a fulfillment of the Jewish prophecies for Jerusalem and for Israel. In order to be a Christ follower, you first had to be Jewish, or had to follow Judaism, and that meant following the law. And then you're now basically a part of Reformed Judaism, which was, in their mind, Christianity. Paul is saying, no, this is a new deal. This new covenant was prophesied in the Old Testament, but it's a break from the traditions of the law, which were the center of Jewish culture. And that was, for Paul, a deal breaker. And this is why he makes a big deal in this letter of the issue. When we get to chapters 3 and 4, we'll see exactly how he spells out those differences. But that's what he's concerned about here. And the fact that Titus, who is Greek, was not compelled to be circumcised, which was what the law demanded, was a sign of obedience to the law, was significant. That's why Paul mentions it here. Paul had tangible evidence of the Jerusalem leader's approval, and the evidence was the way they treated Titus. They did not compel him to be circumcised. They accepted him. Paul's opposition came from false brothers. He calls them false brothers, who had an agenda of control. That's the way he describes them. And as we're going to see in a couple of weeks, when we talk more about legalism and the nature of the Old Covenant, it lends itself easily to those leaders who want to control. And that was what Paul was seeing taking place here. When you have strict laws that define what people can and can't do, it's a way in which you can control community. And that was a concern for many people who were questioning Paul. Paul was preaching his radical grace. People are going to be out of control. It won't work. This is not of God. God has always been a holy God who is majoring on control. And now these Christians are claiming freedom from the law. What's going to hold them back from just going crazy? And this can't be of God. That was part of, apparently, the reasoning. He did not yield to those Judaizers for even a moment. Didn't hesitate. That's the point he's making. He said, I was not surprised by this. That's the sense of reading into this. And there was no temptation to yield to that. I didn't have any doubts about what I've been preaching. Paul received apostolic endorsement. It's not just who resisted him, but who basically approved of him. Verse 6. From those who were of high reputation, what they were makes no difference to me. God shows no partiality. Those who were of reputation contributed nothing to me. On the contrary, seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel to this uncircumcised, that is the Gentiles, just as Peter had been to the circumcised, for he who effectually called for Peter in his apostleship to the circumcised effectually worked for me also to the Gentiles. And recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we might go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They only asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I also was eager to do. Number of observations. Leaders who respected by all gave Paul their complete blessing with no additions or subtractions. That's the point Paul makes. They did not amend what I was doing. They did not correct me. They endorsed it. Now, there's some question as to just exactly who these people were. James, Cephas, and John. Very frankly, it's always been assumed that this is James, Peter, and John, the apostles. But we don't know that for sure. And there's some language here that suggests that they are reputed to be authorities. You'd never say that of an apostle. The apostles were recognized as the authorities. it's very likely that these were different James and Cephas and John than the apostles. Nonetheless, they were Jewish believers who had some authority in Jerusalem, had some clout. And they, in many respects, were the people that I'm sure the people in Galatia were expecting to call Paul to the carpet. But Paul notes that these people gave him the right hand of fellowship. Paul's mission was evaluated as being centered on the Gentiles, and they gave him certain liberties that would make him look different than Peter, who was ministering to the Jews. And in this respect, a lot of that confusion apparently was abated, because people were looking at Peter and saying, basically, when Peter goes to the Jews, he basically acts like a Jewish person. He practices a lot of the culture, so forth and so on. Paul doesn't do that. Now, they can't both be right. And the point here is they both are ministering to different cultures and are going to basically have different styles as a result of that. Now, the question of whether Cephas was the same as Peter is an interesting one. And very frankly, I had never thought about this until preparing for this class. Because when you look at John chapter 1, verse 42, you read these words. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at Simon Peter and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated Peter. Cephas is the Aramaic word for rock. Peter is the Greek word for rock. Lots of people in the circles I traveled in just assumed Cephas and Peter were the same person. This is the only verse that equates them. There are good reasons to question whether or not this indeed was the case. The early church saw them as two different people through the second and eighth century. Not everyone, but many of the church fathers saw Cephas and Peter as two different individuals. The only connection is in this verse. Cephas is mentioned only by Paul in 1 Corinthians and Galatians. Nowhere else do we find the name mentioned. The two individuals have different profiles. Peter had a vision of the inclusion of the Gentiles long before the controversies talked about here. It would be out of character for Peter to be flip-flopping on this, but not necessarily Cephas. We know very little about Cephas, whoever he was. Paul refers to both Peter and Cephas in the same context in the verse we just read earlier, where basically he talks about Cephas being one of the authorities and then Peter being assigned to minister to the Jews, Paul to the Gentiles. In the same sentence, he uses Peter and Cephas both. That suggests that in Paul's mind, there was some difference there. And Cephas seems to be distinct from the 12 apostles when his name is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9:5 and 15:5. When you read those passages, in 1 Corinthians 15:5, for example, he's talking about the gospel being once delivered. Once Christ was raised from the dead, he appeared to a number of people, including Cephas and the 12. The 12 are different than Cephas. That suggests that there is a difference. Now, I can't say dogmatically there is a difference. I'm just saying there is good reason to believe they are not the same person. And that helps explain a lot of the apparent inconsistency between Peter's character and this person, Cephas. Now, of course, if you're Roman Catholic, you have very vested interest in keeping them separate. Because Cephas is Peter, you have Paul upstaging Peter here. And if Peter is the Pope, you can't have that. So the Catholic Church has a lot of attention given to defending the difference between Cephas and Peter. But it's interesting to me that Luke, who wrote the book of Acts, was a disciple of Paul. And if you look carefully at the book of Acts mirrors Peter's activity and Paul's activity. Everything Peter did in the first part of Acts, first chapters, Paul does in the second. raising the dead, healing the sick, you know, preaching. Almost item for item, Luke is indicating in writing the gospel that Peter and Paul basically are on par with one another. The reason that the word Cephas is not mentioned in Acts is puzzling. If Cephas was indeed Peter, we don't know. But again, can't be dogmatic, and it doesn't very frankly doesn't make a great deal of difference in terms of the points we get from this passage. Yes.
But it does seem if Peter is able to Cephas, it does give more power, so to say, to the concept that Paul's message is delivered, is valid by the apostles.
Right. Well, the reason we have for that, or the evidence we have for Paul's message being validated by Peter, are the two epistles of Peter, because in that third chapter of Second Peter, I think it's verse 15 or 16, Paul says of our beloved Peter says of our beloved brother Paul, he says that twice. There are many things that he said that are hard to understand, but he calls him the beloved brother. You would not expect that kind of language if Peter and Paul really were on analysis with one another. So the endorsement of Peter comes to us from his letters. Although, yes, when James, Cephas, and John are mentioned here, and we have no explanation of which ones they were, you're wondering. Obviously, the Galatians knew who they were. They didn't need, those are common names. They didn't need an explanation. But I think it's logical for us to assume, or reasonable for us to assume, that these were the apostles, Peter, Paul, and James. But we can't be sure of that. Now we go back and we combine with what we said last week, with what we're saying this week, to draw some lessons for us. God may have touched your life if, and we're just going to fill this scenario out. These are some of the things that Paul uses to indicate that God had touched his life. We can test ourselves the same way. Your new direction does not involve personal self-interest. And I mentioned last week how convenient it is that most people in ministry, when they make a change, it's always for a bigger salary and more prestige and power, so forth and so on. They seldom go in the other direction, which is counterintuitive to the way you expect God to work if he really wants to spread the kingdom. The same is true in our business. I mean, Christian businessmen and women and others, when God calls them, it's always to something that's closer to the American dream, it seems. People don't get called away from that. And that always should raise our eyebrows and say, I'm not sure it's of God. I don't care what kind of revelation you had or what you feel. I can't be sure. But when you basically are going from a position of power, prestige, and comfort to a position that doesn't have as much, and you say God has led you, that sounds more credible. Not that God can't use you going up, but you're just suspicious. That's and Paul's saying, here's one way you can know that God called me. He called me down. He called me away from comfort. Called me away from prestige. Called me away from power. Secondly, your experience involved intimate personal contact with God. He didn't learn this in seminary. He said, basically, God touched my life. I know God personally. I saw the resurrected Christ. Your experience involved a radical direction change in life. I was killing Christians, imprisoning them. Now I'm preaching for them, defending them. There is no naturalistic explanation for what you experienced. There's nothing in Paul's background that would suggest that what had happened to him you could expect. Others see a dramatic godly change in your life. Paul is noting the fact that his reputation is going before him. Here was a guy, people are saying, persecuted us. Now he's basically preaching the gospel. Now we add to that list. You are willing to subject yourself to the broader community of faith. You get resistance from false brethren, and you get endorsement from Orthodox leaders. So when we look at what we can learn by Paul's letter here, there are two ways you learn from Paul. The doctrine he teaches and the example he sets. And what you're doing here is you're seeing something of how Paul defends himself and his spiritual authority. And he gives us something of a template that can be meaningful for us. We talk about our relationship with Christ. This is not a bad place to use as a checklist. How do you know if God's working in my life, or if God has touched my life, or if God has touched someone else's life? This might be a helpful way we've got a bad connection someplace. Lessons for Christian ministry that we can take away from this and life. Ministries need not be long to be significant. I'll tell you how I got there. When we look at everything we know about Paul's life, we can break his story down into 3 10-year periods, roughly. From his conversion in 35 AD, roughly, and these are approximate dates, there's some dispute, there's nothing in Scripture that gives us the exact dates, but these are probably pretty close to the way it was, the 68 AD when he died. Roughly 3 decades. The first decade of Paul's ministry was, we can describe it as preparation. This was before he started his great missionary journeys. Now, he was ministering, but by and large, he was preparing during those years. 3 years, or 10 years of three large missionary journeys, this is where a lot of his work was done through his travels. And then one decade, 10 years of arrest and a series of imprisonments. His ministry, basically, formally, was 1 decade. And before that preparation, and a whole lot of suffering and persecution after that, before his death. If I were God and managing Paul's life, I would have been more efficient in using someone as gifted and talented as he was. I would have basically, first of all, had him converted at the age of 12, a prodigy of the gospel, and I would have basically had him ministry until he was 100 years old and be translated directly to heaven. But I wasn't God. God basically only had his son minister for 3 short years and never traveled very far, never wrote a book, did an awful lot that won him fame and fortune in the world. Certainly didn't get him the kind of prestige that other leaders had. So I shouldn't be surprised when Paul spends a good bit of his time suffering and not a long time in ministry, relatively. The second thing we can note is this. Christian life and ministry are not always fair, efficient, or without conflict from within and without the Christian community. It's not just conflict from out there, it's conflict from within here and among Christians. With respect to the first point, many of us in America have this idea that just like having a vocation and a career, what you want to do is you want to get an education, you want to know what you want to do for early. Get an education, get prepared for it, and then start in your late 20s building this career so by the time you're 50, you're on top of the heap. You're going to be the richest person in the cemetery when you die. You're going to have all the things you dreamed of and lots of people looking to you for tutoring, and basically you're going to have the American dream. That's kind of the way. And if as a Christian, of course, you translate that right into the Christian life. I want to maximize the time I have. I want to accomplish as much as I can. And I want a long, fruitful Christian life and ministry. I want to have lots of widgets at the end, you know, to demonstrate how faithful I've been and how much I've accomplished. That is not necessarily what God's interested in. I'm convinced there are people who are raised up in their faith for one moment in history. And that may be all their role is. I'm not saying they should say, well, I've done my role and I'm going to retire now. We don't know what the role is. But our job is not to plan a career in ministry. There's no indication that Paul basically looked at his ministry as a career in terms of how much he'd get done. He just showed up every moment and lived the moment. And I think that is a lesson that we need to take from that first point. That it's important for us not to try to manage ministry, our ministry in our life, as well so much as showing up in the moment, the relationships we have now, the contacts we have now, the opportunities we have now. Doesn't mean we don't plan. but it means we basically keep our plans at arm's length. Nothing wrong with having a career, nothing wrong with planning for the future. That's wise. But just don't get too obsessed with it and recognize that that may not be at all what God is interested in terms of using you. Christian life is going to have conflict. And it's not going to be conflict from the world. It's going to be conflict from the brothers and sisters in Christ. Paul experienced that. Jesus experienced that. As a matter of fact, I don't know of any biblical characters that didn't experience that. And Peter says, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeals that are coming upon you. There's still some strange thing is happening to you. But the degree you share the experience of Christ, the suffering of Christ, rejoice. And furthermore, he says, look at this as an opportunity to be a blessing. When you're cursed, bless. What Peter's suggesting, is that conflicts and difficulties in life are not obstacles to what God wants us to do. They're opportunities for us to demonstrate and to develop certain character qualities, certain abilities to respond. Sometimes the difficulties we face can be the stage on which he wants us to live out our role in the Christian life. Now, that's very different than the way in which most of us view conflict. We view conflict as something that Satan's trying to resist us, and he could be doing that. But even with that, it's an opportunity to develop and demonstrate character. Or this is an obstacle to ministry. If we did things right, we wouldn't have these problems. Yes, there's something to that. There is sometimes a cause and effect. But even with that, it doesn't change our responsibility. Our responsibility is to respond to the situation we're in with grace, with love, with patience, the fruit of the Spirit. It's an opportunity for us to demonstrate certain character qualities that otherwise wouldn't show up and wouldn't be meaningful. This is why Peter argues, when you're basically treated unjustly, bless those who persecute you. That is powerful. Now, we bless those who bless us, you know, patting on his back, that doesn't mean an awful lot. That's pretty natural. When you bless those who persecute you, that is powerful. And that comes only in a situation where you are under fire, when you are in conflict, when things aren't going your way. Your problems in your marriage, problems with your kids, problems with your work, problems with your education, problems with your health. Those are opportunities to respond. The question is not how do you get out of this, how do I respond to this in a way that demonstrates the Spirit of Christ in me? 2 Peter 4:12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you as that which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. Don't be surprised. To sum up, that's verses 3, 8, and 9 of 2 Peter. To sum up, all of you, be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. And again, just what I've been saying, Peter is not a person who by nature would have been saying this. This obviously sounds like the Holy Spirit speaking through Peter. Thirdly, third lesson we can learn about life and ministry. Life and ministry is a matter of managing conflict as opposed to avoiding it. That goes back to what I was saying earlier about conflict being a part of our life experience. We shouldn't be surprised by it. The church needs to prepare people to face and manage conflicts. Now, this is something, unfortunately, the church doesn't do. The church basically tries to avoid conflicts. The Christian community. The Christian community says, what do we do wrong? There's a conflict. Or is Satan trying to persecute us? That is not the way to look at it. When we experience conflicts, we should have in our soul a smile of, this is our hour. This is now the time for us to show up and demonstrate Christian character. It's not do we get this resolved, but how do we respond to it? When you have someone oppose you who disagrees with you, that's going to be a conflict. It's not a matter of who's right and who's wrong. That may be a part of what needs to come out in terms of who's right and who's wrong. But along with that, The lesson must be seen and learned. How are you going to respond to this? So often, however, when we feel we're right and someone else has wronged us, our chief objective is to basically get the record straight and to straighten someone else out. That may be legitimate, but it shouldn't be our first objective. Our first objective should be, especially if we're in Christian leadership or involved in Christian ministry, our first objective should be, how do we model how to respond to criticism? The first president of Princeton Seminary made this statement in a lecture on preparing people for leadership. He said, when you face opposition, grow antenna, not horns. And of course, what he means by that is listen. You can learn a lot by those who resist you. The church needs to, in its leaders, model how to deal with conflict, how to manage it, how to respond to it, and encourage and help people in the congregation do the same with their brothers and sisters next to them, as well as the world. How to manage conflict. Some ideas. Expect it and face it as an opportunity to develop and demonstrate godly character. I mentioned that before. This should be always our first response. When things are not going our way, this is an opportunity for me to learn something and for me to demonstrate something. Don't personalize the issues. There are two or three things that will kill any conflict resolution. One of them is to take it personally. Now, very frankly, it's hard not to take something personally when someone's attacking you, because oftentimes other people make everything personal. But remember that when someone attacks you personally, it may not be justified in terms of your person. They may be simply making the mistake that so often we make, all of us make, and that is to equate someone's character with their actions or their opinions. And that's not always the case. Just because someone agrees with me or disagrees with me doesn't mean they're evil. But there are many of us who unfortunately have that kind of instinct. If you disagree with me or go in a different direction, have a different conclusion about politics or something else, you're evil. You just don't disagree with me, you're evil. That is very, very dangerous. It makes conflict resolution almost impossible. Conflict resolvers almost always are able to take the issue and say, this is a problem we have to face. You see it this way, I see it this way. Here's the problem. Now, how can we take our perspectives on this and make it work? Solve this problem. Let's get the problem out there, not put it on you or on me. This is oftentimes what needs to take place in marriage counseling. When you have husband and wife who have hurt one another in various ways, impugned one another's motives, a counselor will generally sit them down and say, the problem is not him or her, the problem is that. Now let's all of us look at that and see if we can solve that problem. That is often the only way in which those things get solved. Take the initiative, don't withdraw. In this situation, Paul basically takes the initiative and goes to Jerusalem to resolve this conflict. It's easy for us to withdraw when someone attacks us. To the passive aggressive, I'll just go someplace else. I didn't get treated well in this church, so I'm going to go to the next church. And then 2 years later to the next church. There's some people that just basically go from church to church to church. Whenever they find something they don't like or someone disagrees with them, they move someplace else. And they do the same thing sometimes in their marriages or in their work. They don't work things out because they don't know how to work things out. And the assumption is, basically, if you've hurt me, I don't have to put up with this, I just move on. Now, sometimes it is important to shake the dust off your feet and move on. But in many cases, we do that simply to escape responsibility. Proceed with reason, respect, and humility. Listen. Learn how to listen. Recognize that someone may have a different perspective, and if that perspective is not something I can address unless I understand it. I like a statement Dr. Phil makes on his program. He said, in our large staff, we have all kinds of ideas that come floating in terms of our program. And he said, let me tell you, even the craziest ideas are great ideas for 2 hours. Every idea has 2 hours. In other words, we're going to clear the deck and we're going to give this idea every chance in the world of succeeding in our minds for 2 hours. And if it doesn't work, we throw it out. But it's going to be heard, and we're going to listen to it, hear it out. That's a great idea. If we could demonstrate to people around us that their ideas are going to be listened to. And so often what happens is when someone's got an idea, instinctively my response is, I don't like that idea. I'll tell you why it won't work. And what I'm communicating to that person is, you haven't thought through this very deeply, have you? That's probably at the top of your head. If it was, boy, you don't think very clearly. I'm telling you, you basically are a little bit of an idiot. Only an idiot comes with an idea like that. If your idea really is idiotic, and sometimes they are, all of us are, have idiotic ideas, but you sense that I'm saying, well, tell me more, how would this work? Or how would that work in this situation? Or how would it handle this situation if it should come up? If I show that kind of interest, then if you say, well, at the end of the day, you know, I just don't see how that idea is going to solve these problems. You are not going to feel attacked personally by that. You're going to feel as though you were heard. Very frankly, in most church conflicts, the conflicts don't get resolved because people don't feel respected and heard. If they feel heard, even if their ideas are rejected, they can live with that. It's when they don't feel heard. They aren't given a reasonable response to their concerns. That's when there's unresolved problems. Or there's a sense of haughtiness and lack of humility. Where basically, I assume that my ideas are good and your ideas are bad. That doesn't fly well in terms of convincing people. Be willing to listen and compromise where possible. Not every hill is worth dying on. Paul had some hills he was going to die on. He didn't compromise the gospel, his message, one bit in terms of grace. But there are other hills that are worth giving up. You don't want to die on every hill. And this means that you have to be able to see the big picture. So many of our conflicts as Christians become mountains that should have been nothing but more than molehills. I remember that I've told this story to some of you before, but I still remember it because it's so crazy. In the rural community in South Dakota where I grew up, there are lots of little Lutheran, country Lutheran churches. And one of the neighboring Lutheran churches, it wasn't the one that I attended, my family attended, they were going to build a Sunday school addition on the church building. The farmers on the east side wanted the building addition on the east side of the church, and on the west side of the church. The church split over where you build the addition. I'll tell you, that is a molehill that became a mountain that brought down a church. This is crazy, crazy. But it wasn't crazy to them. And very frankly, there are some molehills that we're on that aren't crazy to us either. And we've got to back up and say, what is the big picture here? What is the kingdom of God really concerned with? How important is it that basically we have an extra Sunday school class for third grade boys? You know, or whatever it might be. This is not a hill worth dying on. And yet many of us are in that kind of culture where little things become deal breakers. Okay. Next week, in the last part of this chapter, we'll look at doctrinal hypocrisy. Or another way of looking at it is the role of fear in terms of divisions in the church, and continue to talk about how do you deal with criticism and divisions. Okay, now we have a chance to talk about it. Yes?
I was asked to make an announcement about the dinner tonight. To encourage more people to come to the dinner at 6 o'clock at the Church for God. They're not having enough people come, so it's not actually paying for the dinner, and so you don't necessarily have to come to the class even to come to the dinner. So bring your family, bring your friends.
This is an advertisement tonight. We had strawberry milkshakes, hot dogs, salad, corn, French fries, and a wonderful vegetable casserole salad.
That's because we get the go box.
What? The milkshakes were great. Strawberry milkshakes.
Did you list the items in the order of their importance?
Yes. In order of their caloric count.
If they don't come, they will have to stop the dinners.
Wonderful food.
Yeah. Any questions or comments? One of the advantages of the Tuesday night classes, we got time to talk about things.
I think it's kind of tricky to find the balance between living fully in the moment, but also
You're right. That's a good point. How do you follow the example in Proverbs of the ant, who's preparing for the long term and yet being like Jesus, where you take no care for tomorrow?
Yeah. Because you can be planning so much for the future that you neglect the moment.
Right.
You miss the moment with family, you miss the moment whatever work you're given to do, and it's like you're always thinking in terms of tomorrow.
Yeah. That's a very good point. I very frankly, I find it, as I've gotten older, to have more respect for the moment. That's something that was harder for me to entertain as important earlier in my life. Although I was never a big planner in terms of long-term plans or goals. That wasn't a part of my personality. But I would have profited from someone very early in my life, my Christian life, taking me aside and say, Jim, as you go through your life, don't miss a moment. And one of the ways in which you can miss the moments that you're in is by having your eyes too far back in the past or too far ahead in the future. Live in the moment. Because the moment is where the Holy Spirit ministers. He doesn't minister in the past or in the future. He ministers in the moment. And that means the people you meet, they're all important. The conversations you have, they aren't trivial. That's where things will happen. And what you do, and the little decisions, that's what's going to make the difference for many people.
Also, the scripture talks about today if you hear the voice of the Lord, and not out of your heart. So there's a lot of emphasis on today.
Right, right. And when you look at Jesus' ministry, he was aware of his hour coming, not yet come. But there's something about his ministry where, in the midst of ministry, he didn't miss much. I mean, it's his garment being touched, or some innocuous person gets pulled out of the crowd and noticed and healed or whatever. He seems to have this relaxed pace where he's never frantic and watching his clock. He didn't have a clock. If you did, he wouldn't have been caring probably. I mean, we are very time conscious, very production conscious, score keeping conscious, and that seems to be. And we can't. Some people dismiss that that's just traditional culture as opposed to modern technological culture. There's a lot to that, but there's more going on here than just cultural differences. I'm good then. Yes,
but I'm just wondering if this might not be fair, but. When it comes to managing conflict and stuff like that, could you address some of your thoughts about Paul and Barnabas?
Well, yeah, I think that's a powerful example. Paul and Barnabas, with respect to John Mark, came to a disagreement where they could not agree, and they resolved it by Barnabas taking John Mark and Paul going in a different direction. Interestingly enough, later in Paul's ministry, Paul had the humility to say, basically, to endorse John Mark and to not say, well, I've written him off. There's no way he can be considered again. He had great respect for John Mark in the end. But there was a time in which Paul and Barnabas disagreed as to
how to handle. Yes, they parted their ways.
In that sense, it's not really avoiding dealing with the instrument.
Well, it's one where they came to a place where they couldn't agree.
And sharp disagreement.
Yeah, sharp disagreement. It was, and we're going to see next week in Acts chapter 15, there are a lot of disagreements as well.
Do we know what they disagreed about?
It was whether John Mark was trustworthy or not. Because John Mark had bailed out of Paul.
On the first trip.
And Paul said, you know, I'm not sure I can trust him. And Barnabas, whose name needs encouragement, he's the one who brought Paul along when no one else would take him. Now he takes John Mark when no one else would take him. So that was Barnabas' character, his reputation. He's the person that'll pick up the wilting flower and nurse it back to health.
But at the same time, God used that split to double the missionaries.
Right, right. We're not going to resolve all conflicts. And I think that's just a... And we shouldn't be embarrassed by that. But I think we need, the way we respond to conflicts is important. They may not be resolved, but our response is not basically to do whatever we have to resolve this. Our response is to respond godly to the conflict.
Okay. The path of bitterness versus the path.
Right, right. Don't take it personally. Don't deal it out personally. Don't return... insult for insult or injustice for injustice. Be the one who takes the initiative and blesses in those situations.
That's hard to do.
Well, it is against our nature to do that.
It's hard when darts are being thrown.
Yeah. But we can't deny that was Jesus' model for us, and that's the apostles are repeating that. But you're right. That is not natural or easy for us to do. But I will attest from personal experience that some surprisingly wonderful things happen when you reach out to people who have been critical of you. In the early years of the ministry of the Bible Church, there were two people in particular who had lots of problems with my preaching, what I was saying, over particular issues. And it grieved me. I wanted to be reconciled in my relationship with them because they both were important people to me and to the church. And what I did is I invited them to become a part of a sermon prep group of five people. And I said, every week we meet at my house for lunch on Monday, and I basically am going to get your feedback from the sermon last Sunday. I'm taking notes. And I'm going to tell you what I'm going to be saying the next Sunday and ask for your feedback. In both cases, two people who were harsh critics became fans and supporters, especially when comments they made and insights they had showed up on Sunday morning in the sermon.
Was that why they changed
their tune? I think that helped. Yeah, I think they felt listened to, and they felt that the danger is when you disagree with someone is to demonize them. And it was harder. It's harder to demonize someone who you sense is reaching out lovingly to you. We tend not to attack people who love us. It's easy to attack people who withdraw from us and return fire. It becomes much easier to continue resisting them. And without mentioning names, there was another elderly person in the congregation who had lots of problems with what I was doing, and another issue. And I remember buying a model airplane and building it. And I gave it to him as a gift. It was an expensive model that I built. And that changed things. I didn't give it to him for any reason. I just Now, if you knew who it was, you know why the airplane was significant. Some of you know who this is. But this is an example of a person who basically had come to the elders and said, you need to fire this guy. He's not worth what you're paying him, which at that point was minimum wage. And in 3 to 4 years, he was a very strong support of my ministry. And I think a lot of that was because he sensed that I really cared about him and was going to demonstrate that in little ways. But even to this day, I mean, we are close friends, and he is a very, very strong supporter.
It's like you had to help them change the way they look at you. You had to impact their perspective.
Yes, I think it's just a simple matter of it's hard. When someone reaches out to you lovingly, it's hard to fight them. Mm-hmm. But very frankly, my instinct is when someone basically misunderstands me or I sense is treating me unjustly, my response is to withdraw. Because I don't need this. They go someplace else. Or it's not my personality to confront people and ream them out. But for a lot of people, that's the way they respond, is, you get in my face, I'll get in your face, kind of thing. Now, that's not my style. I withdraw. But I realize that doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help me, and it doesn't help the situation, it doesn't help them. In those situations, when it happens, I need to, that's an opportunity to move toward them with love, blessing. And not just saying, I'm praying for you, brother, that you'd see the light. that's not it. or let me heap burning coals on your head so you'll feel guilty for the way you treated me. That's not it. It's genuinely coming hand in hand with humility and showing respect for them. You may disagree with them, but I've said before, the best definition of love that I've heard is a commitment to move towards someone else's soul with a commitment to help them reach the desires of their heart. And when I sense that someone moves toward me, takes the initiative toward me, first of all with a desire to understand what are the deepest desires of my heart, and then says, how can I help you realize those desires? I mean, I don't know of a greater compliment of love that anyone can make in actions or words than that. And so that's why I like that definition of love.
Sort of an Andrew Carnegie approach. You show an interest in other people,
yeah.
And then they'll be more interested in you.
Yeah. Dale Carnegie.
Dale Carnegie,
yeah. Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah.
Right. They probably
were
a little different than
they are.
I might be missing the significance and the conflict that Paul was facing there. Can you take us back to this situation then as he was in this gospel passage? Or that gospel passage. With this letter. He got a revelation to go to Jerusalem, right?
Right.
Am I missing something before that he was running into a lot of conflict?
Yes.
With his teaching?
Yes. In the first part of Galatians, we know. If Galatians is the answer, we have to anticipate or guess what the question was. We know from other sources, especially in the book of Acts, that there were a number of people who basically were reverting back to submission to the law as a part of their understanding of what God wanted. Paul was saying in his gospel, you're free from the law. Jesus came not to empower you to fulfill the law, he came to deliver you from the curse of the law. You no longer have to be circumcised. You no longer have to observe the Sabbath on Saturday. You no longer have to basically do all these things in order to merit your being elect or being in favor with God and a justified member of the covenant community. Those are no longer things that make you a part of that community. You're a part of a community of faith by following Abraham, the father of faith. That's an argument he's going to make in the next few chapters. That's what makes you a part of the community. And you are just before God, not because of the righteousness that you produced, but the righteousness that Christ produced for you, and you inherit by faith. That was his message. But there were those who had spent their life in Judaism, committed their life to discipline and to traditions that they were convinced were important in terms of maintaining their status with God, that when they bought into Paul's teaching initially, they were, after looking at it, saying, boy, this is dangerous stuff. It can lead to lawlessness, you know, and all kinds of disobedience. So there were some among them that were teachers that were drawing them back and saying, Paul is all messed up here. Right? Paul is not one of the Jerusalem leaders. He's on his own. He's starting a cult out here, you know, that's contrary to everything we know about God, in terms of God's being holy and demanding obedience, so forth and so on. That was the problem. And Paul writes this letter to correct that.
So he must have felt the need to get support from the Lane's leadership.
Well, he certainly wanted to regain credibility with them. He wanted them to not dismiss his message. And to do that, he had to defend his credibility.
He doesn't really explain what the stronghold of his opposition was.
No.
Was it? I mean, to this day, you have the Jews fighting the Christians for Jerusalem.
Well, we know that the Judaizers in Paul's day basically what they stood for. It was what I just described. That's known. That's a fact of history. As I explained earlier in one of the first classes, there were lots of different versions of Christianity in the first century. Some controversy as to which ones were right. Now, I think historical critics overplay that. The apostles' authority was pretty well established from the beginning, and there's no indication the apostles really varied very much from that. And this is basically including Paul's gospel. Paul's gospel was received by him a revelation, but he passed it on to the other apostles. They received the revelation too. They got it. And they all were on the same page with that. This is why we have the New Testament that we do, and why the Gnostics and the Judaizers and the Marcionites and so forth, all these sects, have basically fallen off. They were these small splinter groups that all had some strange ideas. The Marcionites, for example, were convinced that only Paul's letters were scripture. They found the Gospels to be offensive, and the Old Testament especially to be offensive. But they were never accepted. And the Gnostics, you know, believed that you had a special encounter with God that set you apart by virtue of a mystical experience. That group produced lots of literature, the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, the Qumran community's material was preserved in that community. But they fell by the wayside as well. It is interesting, the same tension between law and grace exists today. I was online this last week and pulled up a video sermon of a series of sermons, but I listened to all of them, which really were phenomenal. I mean, it was a classic example of exactly what Paul was talking about. This person was an evangelical pastor, and he was preaching the necessity of obeying the law, the Ten Commandments, as a means of demonstrating that you were a disciple of Christ. And he was tying that to the Old Testament. And the point he made is that God hasn't changed. God is still a God who demands obedience to be reconciled to him. And Christ came to give us the power to obey the law. And now, he said, you've heard all these preachers out there, these so-called Protestant preachers who are telling you that you're saved basically because of the righteousness of Christ. And don't believe a word of it. He said, that's just an easy escapism from the obligations that God has always had on his people. And boy, it sounded just like, you know, situations that Paul was dealing with.
How close is that to the Roman Catholic?
Well, that's a good question. Where does Roman Catholicism fit on that whole thing? And on an issue of works righteousness and so forth. And I think many people, myself included, would say that traditionally the Roman Catholic Church has been very close to that teaching. And the way it's expressed in the Roman Catholic Church is this: you're saved by grace through faith, but the grace that saves you is a grace that changes you. And it's the change that justifies you. It's God's doing it. It's none of yourself, none of the flesh. It's God doing it. But he actually changes you and gives you a new heart where you are born again from inside, and from the inside out you produce the righteousness that saves you. So it's not something you're proud of or you can boast of, but it's something nonetheless that happens from within you. Now that's not far removed from Campus Crusade for Christ talk.
If you don't produce that righteousness, then?
Then you go to purgatory.
Then you are
what? Go to purgatory to get it.
Yeah, that's...
Well, see, what the Roman Catholic Church does is recognize this. Most people don't die perfect. So what do? You're going to have an empty heaven. Well, this is where purgatory makes sense. Purgatory is a place where you go where you can make up the difference so that you become suitable for heaven. Now, Protestants have a different solution. Protestants don't extend the time. They lower the bar. And they basically lower the bar by saying, well, God is reasonable. He doesn't expect you to be perfect. He just expects you to have a good heart, try hard, and have a good record. Now, I don't know anywhere where God's holiness is basically graded on the curb. Jesus said, basically, if you're angry with a person, he's committed murder. Now, if we take that at face value, what that suggests is that if you have unresolved anger in your life, you are guilty of murder. That's the implication of Jesus' teaching. You can lower the bar and say, well, I don't murder, but I have some anger now and then. But God overlooks that. I don't know where we get that from. But we lower the bar.
So the right perspective would be saying, you know, he's fallacy.
Well,
yes,
but what I would, what so often happens in evangelical circles is we're told we're saved by grace through faith, apart from our works, but the faith that saves us produces the works. In other words, the works don't save you, but you better have them, because that demonstrates you've got the faith. And if you don't have the works, you don't have the faith. What's the difference? You gotta have the works in order to know that you are justified. That's the problem. And I would argue with Paul and with Martin Luther that it is true when a person is born again of God, something changes in their heart. But mankind may not see what God sees. A person in Corinth, Paul could call a saint by calling in chapter 1 and in chapter 3, say, you are acting like mere men of the world. Same people. I think that everyone has fruit of their faith, but some of the fruit may not show on the outside like it does for others. Only God knows. Luther made a distinction between active and passive righteousness. He said the passive righteousness that justifies us is the righteousness that we have nothing to do with. It's all of Christ. We attach to it by faith. Active righteousness is what the Holy Spirit does through us. That's our worship response to the passive righteousness we've been given. And it's important, but it has nothing to do with our justification.
Some people are like being able to pick up nuggets of gold on the surface. Some of us are buried kind of deep.
Yeah.
But God knows it's there.
A couple of observations about resolving conflict.
Yeah.
And I speak as somebody who doesn't particularly care for conflict. And I found a couple of techniques that make it easier. One is when I'm going to have conflict, if there's time, to plan in advance what I'm going to say.
Yes, yeah.
And then the second one is, I find that making myself vulnerable is also helpful. It's a strange paradox, but by making myself vulnerable, I find that I gain strength of some type.
Right. Yeah. Certainly you feel listened, or people feel listened to if you come with humility. Yeah, that's also, those are excellent points. Preparing what you're going to say before you get there, and then making yourself vulnerable. Those are disarming experiences that really demonstrate a willingness to resolve conflict. Very good suggestions. Yes, Martha.
I see the conflict within the community would be an ever-going situation because of the spiritual maturity of the people in the church. You know, some of them are more,
mature, some are less.
So that conflict, is that you call that conflict? Or
so that's what you
that cause of perspective in seeing things differently.
Right.
Definitely will be conflict.
Yeah, that's a very common conflict. You have immature people and more mature people that see things, that see the big picture and see things differently. Something else that's a big part of conflict is just emotional health. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who have all kinds of things that have nothing to do with church business, but they're angry at mom and dad who died 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're taking it out on the pastor and the Sunday school teacher and the board of elders. And they've got nothing, there's nothing they can do to change that. But emotional health has a lot to do with resolving conflict. Very, very frankly, there are some styles of Orthodox Christianity that aren't very healthy. I mean, a lot of real right-wing fundamentalism, boy, there's not a lot of health there emotionally. When you have a paranoid spirit where everybody's out to get you, and you're isolating yourself from everything that doesn't agree with you, that's not very healthy. And if you want to avoid conflict, you're not going to do it by taking that kind of posture. If you're able to resolve conflict, there's not much resolution power there. But we see a lot of that, in the church.
Well, when you judge the spiritual level of something based on the emotional impact that you get from it.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Yeah.
Because emotions are just—they're all over the place.
Part of what makes this difficult right now is the climate in our culture politically is one where all the gloves are off, no holds barred. And if you listen to progressive talk radio and listen to Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, there are two different polls here, you basically are not going to hear a lot of grace in terms of the people who disagree with them. It's pretty wicked out there. I mean, there's a lot of impugning of motives, making fun of their people, ad hominem arguments, attacking people, not their position, but their character, anything you can find on them. And that creates an endorsement of the rules of engagement for the whole culture. We get the idea that if media heroes can do this, then it's okay for us to do that too. And that is not very civil, and very few conflicts get resolved when this kind of posture is taken. And I'm not making a statement politically one way or the other, as I mentioned both sides, because I listen to both. And I want to call in sometimes to a radio station and say, don't you realize that four generations ago, the things you just said would call for a duel and one person would die over this? I mean, in early America, if you said something like this, you'd be challenged to a duel and one of you would die. And we're talking about political leaders. Mm-hmm. And we say, huh? That was in America. So it sure was in America. That was the West Virginia someplace. That wasn't Washington, D.C. It was Washington, D.C. When someone on the floor of Congress basically insulted someone else personally, challenged them for a duel, one of them died. That happened.
I think Alexander Hamilton died.
He did. That's right.
You better be a good shot when you're elected to Congress. But that seems strange to us, but again, that reflects how much our culture has changed, how uncivil it's become. In many respects, I'm not advocating going back to dueling. I think it probably would solve some problems.
In the herd.
What?
In the herd.
Good way of phrasing it.
Jim, would you comment? You know, you were saying there were problems and controversies and difficulties and persecution both from outside the church and from within the church. What about the balance in the New Testament of preparing us for those two things? It seems like when I think about it, just things come to mind about you see some of the examples like this, but you don't see much explicit talk about it. They're all the one another passages and talk about doing things right, but not a whole lot of...
Like forbearing with one another?
Yeah.
And forgiving one another?
Yeah. But I mean, it doesn't sound like they're going to be knocked down, drag out.
Well, you know, you don't see much bloodletting, but I think when you look at the exhortations in the letters of Paul and Peter, there's a lot of forbearing with one another, forgiving one another, not returning evil for evil. He's not talking there about the pagans who are coming after you. He's talking about brothers and sisters. You don't have to forbear with and forgive your brothers and sisters unless they've done something that requires forgiveness. So although there's certainly a lot of attention given to basically how you relate to the world and how you take it on the chin in the world, but there's also a lot of exhortations that are applied most directly to the way in which we live in a community of Christians. And I'm frankly surprised at how many the exhortations have to do with our response to difficulties. The most dramatic, I think, is 1 Corinthians 13, the passage on love. Love is patient, kind, long-suffering. When you read that list, all of them are a response to something that happened to you that wasn't good. You know, why do I have to be patient? I'm a Christian. I should be treated like a Christian. People should treat me Christianly. Love doesn't take into account a wrong suffered. This is a church. I shouldn't be suffering wrongly.
I guess it's all there, but it still sounds sort of surprising for you to say sort of equally expect.
Well, I don't know how equal it is. I just know from experience you're going to catch a lot of it wherever you are in a fallen world.
Yeah.
The church is not immune to that. And very frankly, even
usually
the best churches I know, that there are going to be conflicts. And the conflicts come from personality disorders, they come from immature and mature Christians, they come from mature Christians that can't get along and have bad attitudes. They come from just all over the place. The point is, we don't have to sort about where they come from. We have to respond to them. And I think the information we have in the New Testament does not ask us to find out where the conflicts come from. And there's not a lot of encouragement to say they all come from Satan. There's a lot of encouragement to say, here's the way you respond to life. And that's, again, when you talk about showing up at the moment, that's your moment. That's our moment. I don't have to dig in the past and say, why are you this way? Or this is what's going to happen to you if you don't. That's not my business. But I can show up in the moment. And I can listen, be slow to speak, quick to hear, slow to anger. As James said, that's true religion. That's the kingdom of God.
I didn't see many Christians or leaders in different situations other than churches too, are too quick to condemn somebody just because conflict is stirred up.
Oh, yeah. Now, to be fair, Paul recognized that when you find someone who's just a troublemaker, in other words, they're in there just to cause trouble, he said basically you deal with that with discipline.
But that's different from what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's not common, but it's there.
Right.
So
again,
we take care of that. But then, apart from that, there's just a lot of stuff that it need not be there.
Right.
But it's there.
Right. So it's like the difference in their motivation. I mean, a troublemaker is somebody who just plain and simple wants to stir up an argument. They want the conflict.
Right.
But somebody else who may essentially cause some conflict could simply be seeking for the truth or seeking for balance or seeking to understand.
Yeah. So this is where, you know, I think conflict is a big umbrella where you have hostility at one extreme, where people are attacking one another, and challenging on the other, or inquiring. And one can be very civil and necessary, the other can be unnecessary. Some of us don't know how to challenge someone without being hostile. That's the problem. This is where we need to prepare churches to deal with conflict. That is, to keep things from becoming hostile, so people can get disagreements, can be reasonable, humble, so forth and so on, and listen and be heard without basically having to blow a gasket and start a civil war.
And some of us don't know how to be challenged without getting defensive.
That's right. The church should be training us to do that. There should be a Sunday school class on how to manage conflict in your home, in your work, and in church. What? Well, I'm doing a seminar for a Lutheran church at the beach next month on four characteristics of a leader, and this is basically what I'm going to say. A leader has to be able to manage four things. This is true in business, it's true in the church, it's true in the family. If you don't manage these things, you can't be a leader, effective leader, a good leader. You have to manage vision. You have to basically give people an idea of where we're going, why we exist. And that's a leader's job, to set the vision. You have to be able to manage relationships. You have to be able to show people how they can work together to reach that vision, how they can cooperate and be a part of a community. You have to manage relationships. Thirdly, you have to basically manage fear. People are going to have different levels of fear, and usually they're going to be afraid of going someplace that they haven't personally decided to go. When the leader says, we're going to go this and do this, that scares some people to death. Usually the leaders aren't afraid. They're fearless. But most people are afraid. And a leader has to manage his or her fear, help other people manage their fear, and teach them how to control and manage their fear. The fourth thing, you've got to manage conflict. There's going to be disagreement. There's going to be obstacles. And a leader's responsibility is to help people manage that so it's constructive. Those three things, manage vision, manage relationships, manage fear, and manage conflict. I found that a leader that does not give respect to people's fears and does not help them manage them will not have followers. They'll have opposition, and they'll leave. And very frankly, in many churches, that is the one that is the tripwire. Because a lot of people have opposition because they're afraid of what might happen or what they might lose. And a leader should anticipate that and help people work through that. Yes?
How do you think behind Galatians, where Paul's basically saying, you know, Christ did not empower us to fulfill the law, he rescued us from the law. But then in Romans, the first couple of chapters, he's talking about people and our behavior,
right,
certain sins, this and that, and he says, you know, that they receive themselves the penalty of their own. So he makes it clear that the end result of these activities will be death / punishment from God.
Right.
But he's writing this to the church in Rome.
Right. But he's not talking there about Christians. He's talking about basically what happens to those outside of Christ. Outside of Christ, there is no umbrella. You're left with your own righteousness. When people have asked me in public forums if, as an evangelical Christian, I believe that only evangelical Christians go to heaven, I tell them, I don't know who goes to heaven. That's God's business. I do know this. God is holy, and he simply asks us as his image bearers to be like him. He asks us to be true to ourselves as human beings. And some of us feel as though we've failed miserably at that. And for those of us who have that gnawing sense of shame and not living up to our potential as human beings created in God's image, he sent his son to provide righteousness for us. We've accepted that gift. You don't have to accept that gift. You can stand before God based on your own righteousness and know that he'll be perfectly fair. No one will have a just cause to say, God, you don't understand. You didn't treat me fairly. No one's going to have that charge. But you don't have to accept Christ. You can basically go on your own if you like. And that's what Paul's getting at in Romans chapter 1. There are some that will be going on their own. They're going to have their own record to stand on. I don't want to be in that number.
That's probably one. You will see one.
Yeah. Okay. See you next week.